and welcome to The Extra Edge, a sports analytics podcast powered by Connexon Sports. I'm Dave Gringinski, and today we're talking with Tyler Friedrich. Tyler is in his seventh year at Stanford University. He oversees all strength and conditioning and sports science initiatives for Stanford's Olympic team, Olympic sports, but it doesn't stop there. He also designs and implements sports performance programs for women's volleyball, beach volleyball, women's rowing, and men's gymnastics. And prior to joining the staff at Stanford, he played a big part in integrating sports technology at Arizona State University. Busy man, Tyler. Thanks for taking some time for us and fitting us in your schedule here on the Extra Edge podcast.
Of course. Thank you. Looking forward to having a chat.
So your work with the women's volleyball team does not go unnoticed. Stanford, according to the NCAA, is the most successful program in Division I women's college volleyball history with 9 national championships. You're coming off a 29-4 regular season. You only lost one game on the road. You made it to another regional final. You've been Pac-12 champions 7 times, including the past 2 seasons, and you've made 23 NCAA Final Four appearances. I mean, this is it. This is the coup de grace in women's volleyball at Stanford University. And then, Tyler, and on this podcast, we love that, you know, we talk about data, collecting the data and analytics, and then the insights that you get, and then the action that you take from everything that you collected. So I'm very curious to find out. Let's start with the data. Did you find sports data, or did sports data find you?
I think there's a little bit of a two-way street on that one. I mean, I have always been just really interested in ways that we can find an edge, like what little pieces are out there that we can add to our arsenal to give us, you know, that extra edge on the opponent. And so as I progressed in my career, that's kind of been my mindset, is like, what's next? How can we push? Where do we get better? And so that will probably start the search, you know. And on the other side of things, like the technology, the growth of social media, all of these things has made seen what people are doing, affordability of the tech, much more accessible. And so I think with more accessibility and my interest in merging the two between like your traditional strength and conditioning and then merging that with sports science, I think we kind of found each other. And as my worlds have collided over the last 5 years pretty heavily, just kind of edging through and finding how I can take this information and make it applicable to our settings, and then kind of have this like back and forth where, you know, we're leaning on the science heavily at times and leaning on, you know, traditional strength conditioning practices at other times. So it's been a very nice, I feel very comfortable with where I'm at in terms of like that give and take of the two sides of it.
But do you remember your first exposure to it? Was it before Arizona State, or was it at Arizona State?
I mean, it was probably like at Arizona State. I mean, there were only a few schools, you know, in 2010, 11, 12 that were kind of using this effect, like at some level. We did a few demos of it there. So that was like the hard, like big data sets. But other things like wellness surveys and RPE scale, that stuff was becoming more mainstream. Not saying people weren't doing it before, because, you know, these Bork scales or Likert scales have been around forever. But it was being seen more like in the strength and conditioning setting at a high level. And so that's kind of where I started to kind of really see where we can do this, and like just kind of understanding how to manage workloads, how to use these insights. Force plates then were still a little bit on the periphery, I would say, just in terms of you could access force plates, access software, but the two didn't always work together, or you needed like a very robust software to break down this data. So I think that's early on for me in my career. I mean, I was lucky at Arizona State, like it, Power 5 institution, had the resources willing to dedicate to stuff like this. So that helped with the exposure. The schools that before that, University of Dayton, my alma mater, love it to death. The resources weren't there to really even know this stuff could be used. So like, I think resources helped kind of drive like my first exposures.
Right. And so, I mean, your first exposure, you have to embrace it. Right. And then you kind of have to learn about it. Right. I mean, it's new. What was that learning process like, and where has it gotten you today?
Mm-hmm. Reading and podcasts were the two big ones. I mean, I know podcasts have been around for a minute now, but I feel like in 2012 and 13, podcasts weren't quite as mainstream as they are today. Was a bajillion of them, but they were out there. And so just finding those podcasts and hearing what other people were doing, was like pretty eye-opening for me. Like, like people are doing stuff, people are pushing the limits, doing things that are maybe unconventional, that, you know, we would consider mainstream today. And so that's, I think that was a huge form of education. Then you hear something, and then the way my process works, I hear what someone's doing. That sounds like something I could do. Okay, I take it to, now I'm going to maybe dive into the research, dive into if someone has a blog post on it or a social media post about it, and see what other people are doing. And then I like just, you know, I believe nothing is really cookie cutter, like cut and paste. And so it's like, okay, how do I take what they are doing and iterate it that would work for us based on maybe either other iterations I see, my constraints, my resources, my knowledge, my skill set, my interest. So there's lots of factors that play a role. But yeah, it's very multifactorial, kind of how I take that information and make it part of my process. But it's, that's kind of how I go about it.
And so, I mean, you're wearing a lot of hats over there. You're helping a lot of different teams. But for the purposes of this podcast, let's kind of lean towards volleyball and women's volleyball, because, one of the things that, we're seeing is that we think that there should be a different approach between men and women. And I want to ask you, in your data collection process, and we'll get into some of the specifics here in a minute, but is there, would you say there should be a difference, or is there a difference when you're collecting data on women athletes versus men athletes?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's going to be sport specific. I think it's like, and if you're comparing like the men's volleyball game and the women's volleyball game, the games are different in terms of what metrics may or may not matter, but in terms of collection, I don't think there's any differences. I think you find approaches that are both reliable and are valid, have validity to them, and are specific or general enough to like to kind of cast a wide net. And then it's on the analytics side, the analysis side, where we dive in and find the things that matter most for that sport. So again, if I'm wearing a GPS unit and maybe like men's basketball players are wearing it, women's basketball players can wear the same thing. I mean, it's no different, but we should expect maybe some differences because of the style of the game, style of player. So there's differences there, but in terms of actually like how to collect, same thing.
But the importance is that you're doing it, right?
Correct. Correct. Well, yeah, you can't have data if you don't collect data.
Yeah.
And I tell this to my staff a lot is, even if you aren't sure what to look at, even if you aren't sure what matters, you'll learn those things, but you can't go back and do a retro analysis if you don't have anything collected. So where I push hard, like just at a minimum, get stuff in the door. And if you don't have the bandwidth, the knowledge, the skill set, the desire right now, that's okay. But push yourself to get there, and then you can always look back on data later. I was someone like this as well. It's like, once you kind of identify something that's important, either a piece of technology or a certain metric, and you start going down that rabbit hole with it, and you realize like, I've been training this team for 4 years. I'm missing 3 years of data on this. That's a huge miss. So I just tell people like, don't make that mistake. It's okay. Just like get the stuff in the door and then figure out later, like what matters.
So speaking of the data, the metrics that you like to look at, I always like to ask people, Phil Lieneman, he's an NBA guy. And he coined the phrase, and I stole it from him, the metrics trifecta. I love it because, you know, there's so many different metrics out there that you could follow, but, you know, it's probably a little easier if you can narrow it down to, you know, a few of your favorites. For you, what would you say is your metrics trifecta? What are the top three that you say that, let's say, you just couldn't live without?
Yeah, it's difficult because it actually will be the time of year dependent, but if I could not live without some sort of workload number. So like, you know, for our volleyball team, it's, you know, Connexon's accumulated acceleration load. We just call it load. So we can manage practice volumes. And then the two other metrics I like come from force plates. It's going to be vertical velocity at takeoff, so how fast they're jumping, and then peak power relative to body weight. Those are the three that if I, you know, can look at those three, they kind of work in conjunction with each other. There's relationships there, but also I can manage practice loads and also get an idea of training status and output ability. So those are the three. If I only be limited to three, those would be the ones I couldn't live without.
Well, you practice what you preach, because folks, if you do not follow Tyler Friedrich on Instagram, you ought to be, because he is helping. I mean, his Instagram is essentially what we're trying to do with this podcast, is to educate people, you know, about collecting data, using and everything. And, you know, one of the things you have on it, the practice versus game day load, that bar graph. Can you kind of, you know, in layman's terms for us, can you kind of explain, you know, what it is we're looking at here and what why that bar graph is so important?
Essentially, does our training match what a game looks like? Knowing that the game is theoretically the hardest thing they will do. So hardest thing that they'll do. Are we training to meet that demand, essentially? And so I kind of like it. Like if I'm training to run a mile as fast as possible, but I never run fast or I never run a mile, am I training myself to actually be the best I can at running that 1 mile as fast as I can? And so similar concepts. And so we have our game days, and we look at game day 1 day before, 2 days before, and 3 days before. And so for us, like days 3 days out and 2 days out are our hardest work days. And so we want to make sure those hardest work days, both from a volume and intensity standpoint, are in the realm of what a game looks like. So that on game day, we're not like, oh, we've never even been exposed to this before, because that's when you're at risk for injury. And so we think of everything as training, even games, which I know can be controversial or whatever. But we want to make sure our training is matching, like, and preparing us for like the critical moments, which is the games.
Hey, Tyler, we don't shy away from controversy here on the Extra Edge podcast. I just want you to know that. But, you know, now in this, and it always seems to naturally spill into the insights. And, you know, we'll talk about some of the insights, like, you know, on top of this one that you get. But I'm just curious, you know, as long as you've been doing this, when the data comes in, are there still things that surprise you even to this day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I mean, you don't have to name names, but I mean, like, you know, you say, you know, like, you're like, wow, I didn't know she could do that, or, you know, or anything like, yeah, those aha moments still.
For sure. I mean, as the years have gone on, and I just understand the context better when you see things where people like just do things that are really surprising. Like we have a freshman on our volleyball team right now, Jordan Harvey, and she is a very explosive and strong athlete, and she comes in and, you know, we have years of numbers on our athletes from our force plates and things like that. And she comes in and she's topping the charts across the board, basically, you know, and she's a relatively untrained, very raw athlete. And what she can do is coming in the outputs, it's just like, wow. So like, I think that kind of surprises me more so versus like a certain metric being, like I didn't know that the value of a certain metric per se. Not saying I know everything, because I definitely do not. But I feel as the years have gone on, I've kind of dialed in like what metrics are a little bit like unreliable, which metrics are reliable, which ones kind of tell the story a little better. So it's when an athlete does things that are like incredibly well or incredibly poorly. I think those are the ones that kind of jump out. It's like, ooh, like I didn't think we would be this good, or ooh, I didn't think we could be this bad. And both of which have their challenges, and both of which excite me for different reasons, to be honest. And so
I mean,
that's probably the most surprising.
Yeah. But that, you know, just tells you the power of this, the information, you know, that it provides. And you know, it's a perfect segue. You know, you're talking about how, you know, you look at some metrics and over the years you've kind of figured out, you know, which ones you can rely on and which ones you don't. Again, I go back to your Instagram where you're talking about the vertical velocity at takeoff. And you say, look, it's key. Don't get me wrong. I get it. You know, but you're like, don't underestimate the need for force. So, you know, for a coach who, you know, thinks right now I'm speaking French to them, you know, like, cause we find a lot of there are a lot of coaches that just, you know, are still kind of figuring all this stuff out. So what does that mean? You know, the takeoff velocity versus the need for force.
So when we think of power, you know, a lot of people say this athlete is powerful or you need power to jump. And we know this, like, peak power during jumping, especially relative to your body weight, will determine jump height, essentially. But power is force times velocity. So to me, and maybe this is very generalizing, but there's two, you need force and you need velocity. And obviously, if both of them improve, like power should go up. What we've noticed over the years is we have athletes who are either force dominant or velocity dominant. So like me, like I've been offensive line in college. Like I'm a force dominant athlete. I jump very slowly. It's pitiful. We have other athletes who, like your springy, really explosive athletes who are, we would classify them as more velocity dependent. And what we've seen with our data, but it's in the research, like vertical velocity is everything at takeoff. Like if you are jumping slow, you will not jump high. And that's just simply because the effect of gravity really is what you haven't overcome that effect of gravity. So we know jumping fast is important. That being said, if we're improving speed, but force is either staying the same or going down, like the gains we can make aren't nearly as impactful or noticeable as they could be if we improve both. And so the way we're kind of thinking about it is like there are moments of time where we want to improve force. We're okay with velocity not improving. Other times of year, we want to make sure that we're hammering the velocity. So we kind of build. So I like to build the force base first. So strength, work on the strength side of things. So the capacity of the muscle to produce high amounts of peak force is up. And then we can say, can now convert that to moving that high amounts of force as fast as possible, which should improve vertical velocity. The next step we're trying to get into is maybe beyond your question is, are either way of the spectrum, are force dependent or velocity dependent, are we at risk for certain injuries? You know, like if I'm a springy athletics kid, athlete who has high velocity outputs that most of peak power is based on is velocity based. Are they at risk for certain types of injuries because they don't have the force to back it up? And then vice versa, if I'm a big force producer, but it can't move quickly, I'm lacking rate of force development, am I at risk for certain injuries? And so that's our next step. And I know it's beyond your question. I'm really excited about trying to go down that rabbit hole and figure that out and correlate to some injuries. But so anyways, go back to the beginning. That's what I think about with force and velocity. Like it's nice pendulum. We need both to maximize power. But bottom line, you're not jumping high if you're not jumping fast.
Well, and I think another thing that I love, you know, the line graph that you put, when you get into the insights, like this to me is easy a way to understand, you know, you're collecting data and then you get insights, but then you see results. That line graph you have up there on jump performance, the jump height performance, like says it all, because all you see is that line just gradually going up. Can you talk, you know, can you give us a little background on that graphic?
Yeah, so that graphic is I'm looking at right now, so I know what I'm looking at here. Yeah, so that graphic is a calendar year, January through December, of a singular athlete. And it's kind of just looking at where this athlete started and then where she ended at end of the season. And the way we do things is early in the year, we're force-based. So we see a little bit of lower jumping, which we're okay with because we're not really trying to maximize jump height. We're trying to maximize, again, like I said before, the capacity of the muscle to produce force. And as we kind of edge more towards the end of the spring, into the summer, then into the fall, that kind of changes a little bit. And now we're putting more emphasis on jumping speed. And so what I love about the graph and this athlete in particular is, one, she put in a lot of really good work to get to this point. But also like at the end of the season, like we are jumping our best, you know, it's showing that like the methodology is working, or there's something there at least. And then it's really great to see someone develop, you know, over a calendar year, even through a season of, hey, like we can still train hard and train to maximize certain qualities, even when our volleyball volume is really high, which I think is also kind of a misnomer in the world of sports performance. I think also in the world of volleyball, it's like, we shouldn't be training hard in season, but like we look at it completely different. We think in-season training, we can target certain variables. We can target certain outputs. And I think this is one example of how like we can develop an athlete even when they're playing a ton of volleyball.
Well, and that sets us up to talk about the action, some of the things that you guys do to get your athletes to this point. But before we get to there, you mentioned it. Like you can have all the data and analytics in the world and you could take it to the players, but if they're not putting it into action and doing the work, nothing will come of it. And I've heard similar stories like this where, you know, yes, the numbers have gone up, but there is a lot of work, individual work by the athlete that goes into this. Is that fair in saying?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and some athletes will And every strength coach has experienced this. Some athletes will get stronger just by looking at weights, you know, especially as they come in and 18 years old, like they'll just by doing anything, they get better. You know, some motor patterns get more refined. And you know, just the training's a bit more targeted and specific. Like you'll see a lot of improvements. What we do here, so we see that too, but that eventually kind of comes to an end. Like those benefits kind of come to an end. So what we're doing here is we're trying to educate our athletes every step of the way as to why we're doing what we're doing, what the expected outcome is, and then we share their data with them on a very frequent basis. And so we can reinforce, like we were trying to work on strength output and your peak force number went from Y to Z, you know? And so we try to show them like, look, here's the fruits of your labor. And even though jump height maybe didn't go up and everyone understands jump height, they want it to be higher, especially in a sport like volleyball. I think any sport likes higher jumping, but so even though jump height may stay the same or even go down, it's like, look, like it's okay. Like, here is what improved. And so now we're setting up the next piece. And so, and we are very diligent with our education of athletes, which I think does keep them in the fold. And so that's part of like them being diligent with their own work ethic and needing to be a part. And they're partners with us. Like we're designing the programs, obviously, and we're taking them through it. But at the end of the day, like they're all along for the ride too. And so we want to make sure that they are believing in what they're doing, because it's that can be very powerful stimulus for them for improvement.
Do you think the data collection and then, you know, you start looking at some of the insights, does that provide that internal motivation for players? And then also, I mean, and for the lack of a better term, does it maybe pit them against each other a little bit too?
Yeah, I think for some athletes, it definitely provides some motivation, some internal motivation. I think I think the Stanford student athlete is a little bit unique because, of course, there are athletes out there who just don't care. At Stanford, we just tend to get a lot of athletes that are results driven. I think just the high academic standards of the university kind of just lend itself to that. And so because of that, they want to see the results. So it's a little bit easier here, just, you know, admittedly that athletes are willing to see the information and they want to see progress. They want to see improvements. And so that makes life a little bit easier. I don't know if it pits them against each other per se. At times, there's definitely competitive nature. We're not really trying to create that. Some of our teams do, but we're like in volleyball, like we don't really try to create it, like, oh, hey, oh, here we go. But there, it definitely comes up. And when it comes up, like I want to foster that. Like I want a competitive environment. I'm not like, hey guys, come on, everyone's their own, end of one. No, like we're fostering that. But at the same time, like I think the athlete just really wants to see their own personal progress and see how like they're continuing to improve. And so, yeah, I think that's our athletes are very intuitive, which is cool. Like they want to know what's going on, which is awesome. Awesome.
All right, now that they know, now let's talk about what they can do. Let's get into some of the action. And I see the videos that you're posting. I mean, you've got your athletes doing squats with giant chains on the bar, not just weight plates, but you got chains and things hanging off. And, you know, I see a lot of squats. So talk about like what, you know, both in the weight room and even, you know, even on the court, whether it's drills and things, what are some of the things, you know, you don't have to give away any secrets, but, you know, what are some of the things that you do that you just think are extremely beneficial for, you know, volleyball players in particular, or maybe just athletes in general?
Yeah. I mean, there are no secrets. I think what I do is very simple training for the most part. Like, again, I'm targeting force or velocity. And within that realm, there's like different caveats, but like basically force is strength. So like, how do you get stronger essentially? And that's when like the chains come into place. So we will spend a chunk. Well, we go to the beginning. We first spend our off season doing like a lot of isometric work. And that's just to have more time under tension, kind of just bring them back up to speed after like a long winter break. We'll do that for 3-ish weeks, laying the foundation essentially is how I look at it. Like we want a strong strength foundation. We want them to be like, it's like kind of build up. They get really sore the first week as every team does and they come back from break. And so it's nice because we can get them really sore. We know isometrics is good for their tendons. We know it's going to increase muscle tension. So everything about it is great. So we do it for 3 weeks. We transition that to an eccentric phase. So that's like, if we have our foundation of the isometrics, this is like, the framework of the house, right? This is like, what's going to, I think of the eccentric work as like making sure the house doesn't blow down if there's a strong wind, if the gust of wind. So we want to make a really strong, framework for the house. Eccentric strength especially in a jumping sport. We want to be able to create strength eccentrically so that we can get more force coming back up the other way when we do jump. And also the other analogy I use for this is like, ultimately we want to be cannons. We want to be explosive athletes, but you're not going to shoot a cannon out of a rowboat, right? So we're building a strong, robust aircraft destroyer thing that we can just, you know, like make them really strong. And that's our eccentric work. So that's about four to five-ish weeks. And then we will transition to more concentric. And that's where we'll bust out the chains. And chain is trying to maximize peak force, right? As you squat down or you lower the weight, the chains coil on the floor. So the load gets lighter. So in the least advantageous position, the least efficient position, so bottom of a squat, bottom of a bench, where you have the least amount of ability to create force, the weight is the lightest. But as you work through the range of motion, we need to start producing more and more force. And that is how a great way to get strong is, you know, because if you're just doing a regular bench press or regular squat, you know, in the bottom, you're working on the strength. But as you work your way up, it gets easier. So the muscles aren't working quite as hard, which is, you know, a very generalized term, but essentially that's what's happening. They don't need as much force, right? If you have chains, you have to produce force, high amounts of force all the way through the range of motion. And so that is the point of that. So basically we're telling the brain to tell the muscles, force, 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 force. So then we build a nice force base. We're strong now. Then we put on the bands. And the bands is where we say, okay, look, now you have to overcome this band tension. You got to move fast, right? And so that last like five-ish weeks of our spring is all about moving weight as quickly as possible. So we've built the foundation. We've done the eccentric work. We have nice, strong. Now, like we built a huge cannon, lots of power behind it. Now we want that cannon to fire at a very explosive rate. So we just kind of slowly build up. And when it's all said and done, hopefully, to keep using this ship and cannon analogy, we have this big ass cannon that can fire really explosively. And when it does, we're not going to destroy the boat, AKA our tendons, our muscles, ligaments, stuff like that.
That's a great analogy. I wrote that down. I love that though. But see, this is why you're here, Tyler. Like, you know, to put that, you know, to paint that picture for us. And I really appreciate that. One thing, you know, that, okay, there's two things that as we're rounding third here and heading home, but I want to address two things. One, I think the simple answer when somebody says, you know, or they hear sports analytics or sports data analytics is, oh, they must get some stats and stuff from the game and then look at it. And, you know, but what I think the more complicated answer is, like, this is year long, right? I mean, this is off season, in season. This is all year long. You're taking this data, collecting it, and applying it, whether, like I said, in the weight room, you know, or on the court, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's in one way or the other, we're utilizing some set of data. So if it's in the weight room, a lot of times it's velocity based work or force plate. So we're getting data on how quickly they're moving the bar or how slowly, depends on what we're working on. And we're collecting force plate data to see like what their outputs are. And then when on the court, we're looking at external loading metrics. And the external loading metrics are probably the bulk of our year in terms of what we're looking at, especially in season, because that's how we're managing practices. That's how we're managing workloads. If we have reserves to do more work, all these things inform so much of what we do. Our weekly practice structure is informed through this, through our data from Connexon. And even then also our recovery modalities as well. If we see consistent high loads or we have back-to-back high games or whatever the situation is, we can say, look, like these, our athletes are probably blown up. So we need to change the way we recover or maybe change what we do in the weight room because of these numbers. Now, yeah. So we believe that like if we are managing practice loads correctly, like the high loads of games and the high intensities of games aren't as impactful because we're trained for it. So it may or may not affect a recovery or a planned weight room session. But we definitely have made those changes if we see kids or athletes, he's saying kids, we see our athletes just kind of get blown up, which happens. I mean, especially in volleyball, like, you know, a 3-set match can be 90 minutes. You play a deep 5 setter, it can be 3 hours, you know? And so, and you may have those back to back. And so it may change your whole plans, which is, you know, so it, long story short, data is year long for us. What we're looking at, what we're focused on will change. But it drives a lot of what we do. Now, are we tied to it? Are we hamstrung by it? Absolutely not. Like, it is a informative piece of our puzzle. We lean on it heavily, but I wouldn't describe us as like, ooh, the data says we should do this, so we have to do it. Like, we as coaches, and I'm speaking for myself and our head volleyball coach, who's into the stuff to the nth degree. It's amazing. He loves it. We use it to inform decisions, but I wouldn't say we're hamstrung by it in any way, shape, or form.
It's a tool. That's one of the best ways I've heard of this. You know, you picture your toolbox, right? And this is one of the tools you have in your toolbox. The one thing I wanted to go back to that you said earlier is that you found that you've developed this in season. You train harder than you do in the off season. And again, you don't have to give away any secrets, but what led you to that thinking? Because I just think that's a little fascinating.
The genesis of it is there's a lot of factors that have played into it. Like, we, I don't know where to start. Marrying up like the importance of strength training and the importance of practicing hard at volleyball is a difficult for a lot of people to do. And my head coach and I, like, we just kind of talked through it. We talked through what kind of training in the weight room, what could be effective. How should we be training on the court? How do we maintain fitness? How do we train our athletes' bodies to handle the loads? And I think we both knew what the right answers were. And I think we'd both been he had just come to Stanford in 2017. I had gotten here in 2016. I think we had different situations where maybe we couldn't really align. Like, we knew what we wanted to do, what was right, but either personnel dependent, situation dependent, whatever the reasons were, we couldn't, neither situation really aligned up. And then when he came here, we basically got on the same page day one. He talked about training, and I'm like, I wasn't talking about training. You know what I mean? It literally was a conversation. He's like, I want to train hard. I want to do this. I was like, I was going to recommend the same thing. We were off to the races, right? So that's kind of how it started. It did evolve. It has evolved over time. We've kind of adopted in the weight room this microdosing model, a high frequency strength training, or whatever you want to call it. So we're lifting weights every day in season, 6 days a week, as frequently as possible, which led to, okay, how are we going to be precise with our training? What matters? What days of the week? What do we do at the end of the week? Which evolved to practice planning. What days need to be hard? What should hard look like? What should day before games look like? Day between games? And so it's been an evolution, and we've had the structure's been in place, but each year it gets a little bit more refined. So I would say even we just finished season 8 together. I don't think we wouldn't consider it a finished product. I would consider we're more streamlined and more efficient, but I would not say okay, here's what we do every year. I think it's more okay, here's what we did. What's the tweak this year? What's the tweak next year? So we kind of are always kind of tweaking and finding what's best, because the group changes every year, right? If you have 17 players 1 year and 14 the next, 3 middles 1 year, 1 the next, there's so many factors that play a role. And so we're using all that to, again, maybe dial in what we're doing year to year a little differently.
Yeah, but it's improvise and adjust, right? INA. I remember somebody said, it's always about improvising and adjusting, each year. Tyler, this has been phenomenal. The conversation, one one last action item for you. And obviously, you're the coup de grace. Stanford women's volleyball, you don't get any better than Stanford women's volleyball. But let's say there's a coach out there, maybe at a smaller school, right? And they're like, boy, oh boy, I got a little extra money. Maybe I might be able to get a system, but there's no way I could keep track of all this stuff. Do you have any recommendations? I've heard everything from, schools might ask the math department to see if they have any students who are interested in coming over and helping with the data or the analytics. Maybe there's some interest there. The people you talk to, do you have any advice for coaches who maybe, want to get started, or what's an easy, simple way to get started and also get the help that you need?
Yeah. The advice I give on that is identify what your biggest problem is at the moment. Is it you have data and don't know what to do with it? Is it you have no data and don't know where to start? Is it we have our athletes are overtrained, we get a lot of overuse injuries? Is it they're undertrained and we get overuse injuries? Is it we're not jumping as high? Just identify the main sticking points, and that will hopefully be the first step of like, hey, what do I need? If you have a lot of data, don't know what to do with it. I mean, not saying that you should call me or whatever, but like reference this podcast, reference what are other people doing? What metrics matter? Send emails to peers, send emails to other schools or organizations you know could be or are doing this well. Ask them, like, I'm just trying to get started. Where do I start? This is my experience. I tell my staff the same thing. You can't start until you start. So just start somewhere with something that makes sense to you. And as you ask more questions, like you'll get more comfortable with data, which will then in turn probably lead to more questions, and more questions lead to more metrics coming in. And then you get comfortable with that data, which will then in turn lead to more questions. And the process just repeats itself. And then you look back after 5, 6, 7, 8 years and you're like, oh, I know a lot about this stuff, you know? And so, you got to start somewhere. If your issues are like, you know, you feel like your athletes are overtrained or undertrained, or you don't know how to manage practice loads or whatever, like that stuff requires conversations with coaches, requires, again, like reaching out to other schools, see what people are doing. So don't try to solve the world in one, like, okay, I need all this stuff. I need GPS. I need force plates. Cause that's what Stanford does. Like, just identify your problem and start there. And as you start to chip away at that, you'll notice other solutions become available to you that work best for your situation.
That's awesome. And I don't mean to try to inundate you with emails or DMs on your Instagram, but if somebody did want to reach out to you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
I mean, email is always good. My email is on our Go Stanford website. I answer all those emails. I always find time. I'll never blow anyone off. So if anyone's listening and wants to reach out with a question, just shoot me an email. I'm terrible at answering DMs on social media. I mean, you can, but don't DM me because I probably won't answer it. So,
you got to follow them though on Instagram. I'm telling you that.
I will take the followers for sure.
You're a good follow, man. You can learn something from your Instagram, and I appreciate, you know, when I stumbled onto it and I saw it, I thought, man, this is good. Like you are teaching at the same time, you know, as you are helping athletes. And I really appreciate you coming on, Tyler. This has been awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was fun.
Yes. And remember, if you know a great coach who's doing great things, winning games and doing it with sports data and analytics, we would love to hear about them. We'd even may make them a future guest on the podcast. I mean, we'll have to see if their Instagram's as good as Tyler's, but I mean, we'll still make them a guest. Hey, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Connexon Sports, or look for us on LinkedIn at Connexon Sports and Media. Remember, we want you to innovate the game by collecting the data, getting those insights, and turning those insights into action. We will see you next time.